Last Lord's Day, we talked about the term Sheol. And when we discussed it, I basically made the argument, and you may or may not agree, that the general presentation of Sheol in the Old Testament is one of, it is the place of the dead. It doesn't have any specific negative or positive connotations. Right? The wicked go there, the righteous go there, and it is a waiting place. And so this is where everyone goes when they die. The few exceptions being the very few people who never died, who were taken up directly into heaven. So everyone ultimately goes there. When you get to the New Testament, this is definitely changed. There is definitely an idea that though there is a general realm of the dead, after you die, there's a clear idea of punishments and rewards. All right, punishments for wickedness, rewards for righteousness. We haven't seen that yet in the Bible. We'll get there in a second. Actually, we did see it a few weeks ago, but we will review it. And so in the New Testament, it sort of splits. All right. And when you see the equivalent of Sheol in the New Testament, don't immediately think bad. All right. And I also wouldn't recommend you immediately think good either. Okay. What we're going to start with today is our discussion of Hades. And Hades in the New Testament is equivalent with Sheol. And it does include both ideas. When there is punishment, you will see it say something like, and he was in Sheol undergoing punishment. All right? And so that's how they specify this sort of thing. But we'll get there. So the Old Testament, I would argue, really doesn't have those ideas. You do see these, though, in the intertestamental period. All right. So after the close of the Old Testament, Jews developed an idea that there was a clear split within the realm of the dead. In the new version of the notes I sent out last night, I added some more material. Some of it is from Josephus. All right. I want to read to you a short selection from Josephus, where he describes three different Jewish sects. I imagine all of you would have heard of all of them, maybe only two, because only two of these show up in the New Testament. All right? So on a background of Sheol is just a waiting place of the dead, let me read to you first about the Essenes. Yes, sir. Oh, good point. Thank you very much, Bill. Who is Josephus? Anybody know? All right, go ahead, Michael.
He was a Jewish Roman historian.
Mm-hmm. So Josephus was a general, a leader in the Jewish army in the revolt against Rome. After he was captured, he essentially went over to the Roman side and was he was very positive towards them, maybe because he was in captivity, maybe because he liked them. He is often called Flavius Josephus. Flavius is a Roman term. All right, he took on essentially a Roman name. So he was a Jew, but he was active in the revolt against the Romans and then essentially sort of came on their side after a while. And so this, when he would write these things, he would be writing in like the 60s, 70s, 80s AD. So this would be after a lot of our New Testament, perhaps all of our New Testament was written. And he is, being an insider Jew, himself being a Pharisee specifically, he is writing about his own, essentially, his own religion when he talks about this. So, does that make sense? Cool. Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Michael. So, he talks about three different groups, all right? The Essenes, which don't show up in the New Testament by name, at least. The Pharisees, which do, and the Sadducees. He starts with the Essenes, and this is from his book on the War of the Jews, which was an account of the Jewish revolt against Rome and loss against Rome. For it is a fixed belief of the Essenes that the body is corruptible and its constituent matter impermanent, that the soul is immortal and imperishable, emanating from the finest ether, These souls become entangled, as it were, in the prison house of the body, to which they are dragged down by a sort of natural spell. By once they were released from the bonds of the flesh, then, as though liberated from a long servitude, they rejoice and are borne aloft. For those of you who are familiar with the idea of Gnosticism in the first few centuries of Christianity, this should sound familiar. This is a Greek idea. And he continues, sharing the belief of the sons of Greece, they maintain that for virtuous souls, there is reserved an abode beyond the ocean, a place which is not oppressed by rain or snow or heat, but is refreshed by the ever-gentle breath of the west and coming in from the ocean, while they relegate base souls to a murky and tempestuous dungeon, big with never-ending punishments. This is a Greek idea, and really an idea that they did bring in, at least among the groups of the Essenes. What about the Pharisees? The Pharisees, who are considered the most accurate interpreters of the laws, written by a Pharisee, of course, naturally, and hold the position of the leading sect, which is, I think, most people consider to be true, they were the most common, attribute everything to fate and to God. And they hold that to act rightly or otherwise rests, indeed, for the most part with men, but that in each action fate cooperates. Every soul, they maintain, is imperishable, but the soul of the good alone passes into another body, while the souls of the wicked suffer eternal punishment. And so the souls of the good will resurrect. Remember the gospel accounts where the Pharisees and the Sadducees are essentially fighting about the resurrection? Here's Josephus saying Pharisees believe in the resurrection. The wicked, well, they will suffer eternal punishment. The Sadducees, the second of the orders, do away with fate altogether and remove God beyond not merely the commission, but the very sight of evil. They maintain that man has the free choice of good or evil and that it rests with each man's will, whether he follows the one or the other. As for the persistence of the soul after death, penalties in Hades and rewards, they will have none of them. Moreover, the Pharisees are friendly to one another. Once again, Pharisee talking here. And are for the exercise of concord and regard for the public. But the behavior of the Sadducees one towards one another is in some degree wild, and their conversation with those that are of their own party is as barbarous as if they were strangers to them. And this is what I had to say concerning the philosophic sects of the Jews. And Josephus is somewhat writing to Romans so that the Romans will understand what these Jews that they've been making war against think, right? So, according to Josephus, and you do see this in other documents, and there's more now in the document that I sent to you guys last night, you can see that there is a clear expectation, or a clear idea in a lot of Judaism, not all of it, like the Sadducees, but in a lot of Judaism, that after death, Sheol definitely splits to an idea of a bad place and a good place. But what about the New Testament? Do we see that there in... Ultimately, yes, we're going to see that very clearly in the New. So let's go ahead and start by digging into the New Testament. Hades, let's start with that particular term. We're going to try to cover two today. The first is Hades. The second is Gehenna. We went over this a few weeks ago. Let's review it real quickly. Sheol in the Old Testament... That term, Sheol, is just a transliteration of the Hebrew term. What that means is they just took English letters and used the same English letters that would create the same sound. All right, so Sheol is just a Hebrew word. And as we discussed, it means the realm of the dead. For the New Testament, which is not written in Hebrew, they chose to use this word to talk about this concept. All right, Hades. Well, this sounds like a Greek term, and it is. The New Testament is written in a Greek language, and so they picked up a Greek term. This doesn't mean that when Jesus said Hades, he believed in the existence of the Greek god Hades. That's not the case. They were using this term as, essentially, the equivalent of Sheol. We need to talk about the realm of the dead. This is how the Greeks talked about it in their language. We're using Greek, we're going to use the same word. That's really all it means there. It doesn't mean you necessarily have to bring on all of those Greek ideas. Let's actually start in Acts. So if you would, turn to Acts chapter 2. We're going to be doing lots of scripture reading today and lots of page flipping, so be prepared. And this is one we've already discussed, but it is certainly worth going through again because it's very clear and very useful. Acts chapter 2, the scene is the Spirit has now come on the apostles, and Peter is preaching a sermon. Let's start in verse 22. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it. For David says concerning him, I saw the Lord always before me, for he is at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. My flesh will also dwell, in hope. For you will not abandon my soul to Hades, or let your Holy One see corruption. You have made known to me the paths of life, and you will make me full of gladness with your presence. Now Peter speaks again. Brothers, I say to you with confidence that the patriarch David, that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Okay? And so he goes on to apply this to Jesus. Now, if we think about the English word hell, does anybody have hell there in their translation? Okay? If we think about the English word hell, what connotations does that word have for you? What's that? Negative, and it has the idea of punishment. Hell is not derived from any of these words in Greek or Hebrew. This is Norse, and, you know, Germanic sort of language. Used to, from what I read, hell did not necessarily have the negative connotations. Hell would have been roughly equivalent to Sheol. It could have negative ideas, but it did not necessarily have to have that. But when we use English today, that's usually what we mean. We mean something bad. We don't say, that person followed Jesus when he was good in life and he's going to go to hell when he dies. We don't say that. We strictly reserve that word, all right, to punishment. And so, because English has changed, I don't think we should use this word as liberally as, for example, the King James used to use it. Because for them, well, it actually could be an ambiguous word. But we don't use it that way. And so I'm not going to use, generally speaking, hell as a term for Hades. Because that is a negative thought, right? And then, you know, well, what does that matter here? David, all right, we would not say that David, King David, went to the realm of the dead and then was punished. All right? We don't say that. We don't believe that. We believe that actually he was a man after God's own heart. He was a righteous man. He sinned, but God blessed him. All right? And God loved him. And so we would not say David was punished after he died. And that's not what the psalm is talking about, all right? And not what Peter's talking about. Because when Peter, because if you know, look what he says about here, he says, you know what? Theologically speaking, David, according to Peter, is in Hades, not being punished. Where is he? Well, he's dead. All right? The passage here says, you will not let your Holy One remain in Hades. You will not let him see corruption. What's the point? David's in Hades. And did David see corruption? Yeah. His body, it decayed. He absolutely saw corruption. And, of course, he applies this to Jesus. What about Jesus? Did God allow Jesus to stay in Hades? Did he allow Jesus to see corruption? Well, no. He raised him from the dead before he saw corruption. He was in Hades for 3 days. He did not stay there and get corrupted like David. Ergo, this psalm is not about David. This psalm is about Jesus. That's essentially Peter's argument. So we've got here in Acts a very clear instance of this term Hades, generally meaning just the place of the dead. And you can tell from context, he's not meaning a positive place here. There's no positive spin on Hades here. It is simply the grave. That's essentially what it means. And so Hades shows up here in Acts 2:27, and then in Acts 2:31, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. So those two of your instances of Hades in the New Testament. Now let's back up a little bit and go now to the Gospels. Matthew chapter 11. And this is actually very much like one of the passages we spent a good bit of time with last week. And that is a judgment against a city or nation that they will be brought down to Hades. Remember when we did that? That's what's going on here. Matthew chapter 11. Matthew's recording an event where Jesus is preaching. Right? He's going around preaching. And he has done a lot of works in various cities around. And so in Matthew chapter 11, verse 20, we read this. Then he began to denounce the cities where most of his mighty works had been done, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? You will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I tell you that it will be more tolerable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom than for you. So what's the idea? Jesus has just done a lot of miracles in these cities. They did not repent. They did not recognize him as the Son of God. And so Jesus' statement is simple. You did not recognize me as the Son of God. Judgment now will come upon you. And it's actually going to be worse for you than, for example, Tyre and Sidon. Those were pagan cities, and they did not get all these miracles. It's going to be worse for you than for Sodom. It was another pagan city which did not get all these miracles. All right? It's going to be worse for you in the ultimate day of judgment than them, because you saw all of these things. You are more accountable. In this particular case, when it says you're going to be sent down to Hades, first of all, we should think they're going to be killed. That's, you know, at least the very surface option there. But here it goes on and says a little bit more than that, right? Because it doesn't just stop with an army is going to come kill you, for example, which is generally how cities die. It goes on and says, and in the judgment in the end, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon than for you. So for here to say, go down to Hades, clearly has more of a connotation of negativity. You're going to be brought down to Hades, perhaps before you could have, right? Remember in the Old Testament we talked about the idea of being brought alive into Hades, which is a reference to you being brought, you basically being killed before it was your time. You're not going to Hades when you're old and gray. You're going to Hades much sooner than that because of your wickedness. That's the idea here, I think. But with obvious connotations of, if you're going to Hades early because of your wickedness, when you get there, and then later in the judgment, it will go poorly for you. Yes?
When verse 23
says, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? Is that afterlife heaven, or is that like just earthly exaltation? So, very similar language occurs just like this. Remember in the condemnation of Babylon we went through about 4 weeks ago or something like that, when we were talking about who's being condemned whenever Babylon gets condemned. And we discussed, well, this is probably not a pure reference to, you know, the humanity that lived there, but the spiritual forces behind Babylon. I think this is an intentional reference to that because it essentially uses the same language. What that ultimately turns out to mean is the city, I think, is just, it's not going to be exalted. It's not going to be prosperous. It's not going to become a very powerful city and be the center of much of anything except for actual judgment. And so I think that's what's going on there. I don't think there's much more to it than that. That could be wrong. Yeah, Chip.
Until now, we've been talking about individuals going down the shoal. Here he's talking about cities.
Yeah.
Our populations of cities.
Yeah.
No exceptions.
So, theologically, think of Sodom, right? Remember Abraham's discussion with Sodom. How many righteous people are you going to let die when you destroy Sodom? And what's God's answer? None. Does he destroy Sodom? Yeah. But what does he do before that? He gets Lot out of the city so that he actually can destroy it. This is the same as that psalm we were talking about last time, I believe, where it was talking about nations, not cities, you know, bigger than cities. Nations being brought down to Sheol. What's it talking about there? I think it's talking about the same idea here. That whole nation, essentially, would be destroyed, all right? And its name erased would essentially be the idea there in the psalm. I don't recall which one it is, but it's actually in our Sheol discussion in the notes. And so if you go find it, I think it was in the 90s. I don't remember. Here, I think it's the same basic idea. I don't think he's promising. I don't think he's promising an early visit to Sheol for the righteous. I think he intends that for the city as a whole. If you think about, you know, first century Christianity, and you think about Jesus' warnings to the people, which gets us a little bit off topic, but if you think about Jesus' warnings to the Christians in the Gospels, what's he say? When you see all these things happening, what do you need to do? You need to get out, right? You need to flee. Because if you don't flee, you're going to be destroyed with all of these people. Which is exactly the same thing that happened with Lot in Sodom. He's like, we're yanking you out of here so that you don't die within this group. So I think the idea here, right, is actually all of this fits together very well. Sodom is a very earliest example. That psalm we talked about last time, and really not just that psalm, but all the many condemnations against various cities and nations that happened in the prophets. That's exactly what Jesus is doing here. Jesus is another prophet, more than a prophet, but another prophet coming and declaring just judgment against a very large group of people for not following the Lord. So yeah, it's not individuals, but it certainly would contain individuals. Anything else? Let's continue. There's another example. We won't read it because it's the parallel in Luke, and that's Luke 10:15. Another one, Matthew 16:18. You can go and turn there real quickly. We've already talked about this one several times. And in Matthew 16:18, this is Jesus' statement to Peter. After Peter calls him the Christ, and I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. And the gates of, what's your translation have?
Hades.
Hell or Hades, depending on what you're dealing with, all right? The gates of hell or Hades, right, will not prevail against it, okay? Meaning, the grave can't stand against the church, all right? And once again, gates, we saw this in the discussion of Sheol in the Old Testament. Sheol had gates. Sheol had bars. We had a king who was laying at the gates of Sheol, meaning he was on the verge of death, right? He was at the gates of Sheol, but not inside. Here, right, it's the gates are the door, all right? The gates don't attack, you attack gates. And so this is a statement of Jesus talking about attacking the forces of Hades, not being attacked by Hades, and saying the gates of Hades will not ultimately prevail. In this particular case, does it have negative connotations? I think it probably does. But in reality, all right, doesn't need to, because as we know in the end, Jesus is attacking Hades, right? Jesus is taking everyone out of Hades, all of his people, and resurrecting them. His attack against Hades will not fail, right? Because who is it that now has the keys to the gates of Hades and death? Well, it is Jesus, and we'll see that here in a second when we read in Revelation. Luke 16, 23, another one we discussed. This is the rich man and Lazarus. In Luke 16, 23 is when this shows up. And in Hades, being in torment, he, the rich man, lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side. And he called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things, and Lazarus in the manner bad things, but now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish." A very clear distinction at this point. "And besides all this, between us and you is a great chasm. A great chasm has been fixed in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us." Okay? So this is an interesting notion, and one of the texts I now have in the document for you is from a book called First Enoch. We've had reason to talk about it before, but this is a book that was written by Jews. And this would have been, this particular selection that's in there would have been from like 2 centuries before Jesus, maybe 1 century before Jesus. And so this idea had been in Judaism for a while. First Enoch talks about the split in Sheol and essentially says this. Part of Sheol is set apart for the wicked for punishment, but there's another part that has a spring and is for the righteous. It's this exact same idea. Punishment in one place, the other one, they've got water, and it's pleasant. It's in the document if you're interested in reading it. We don't take it as scripture, but in terms of background, this is not the first idea that you had heard this thing. Contrary, when Jesus talks about it, this is a general understanding. Yes, the righteous are blessed after they are dead, and the wicked are punished. The next instances are in Acts, but we've already read those. Let's now go to Revelation. Revelation chapter 1. If you have a King James Bible, there's one other instance in, I think it's 1 Corinthians, if not it's 2. But it's a textual variant that none of the modern translations use, so we won't go over it. Yes, sir.
Stop just for a second.
Yes.
The two places where they go, are they conscious?
In the parable, they are clearly conscious. Or in the story, whether it's a parable or not. Yeah. It's certainly presented that way. Anything else about that? Okay. Revelation chapter 1. So in Revelation chapter 1, there's a lot of discussions about the realm of the dead and spiritual places. All right. So we'll end up coming here a lot. Hades shows up a number of times. Revelation chapter 1, verse 17. "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead, for he laid his right hand on me, saying, 'Fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and Hades.'" So this is Jesus. I died, but I am alive forevermore. Think about this. If Jesus goes to Hades, all right, because he did, he died for 3 days. If Jesus goes to Hades, he is behind the gates of Hades, right? Why are the gates there? The gates are to keep people out, to keep people in. Logically speaking, if someone can pass into Hades but then pass out again, what does he have? He has the keys to Hades and to death. And so that is Jesus, the one who has risen from the dead, not like those who Jesus rose from the dead and then they died again, but the one who has risen and is to never die again. Well, that must mean he has the keys. He has the keys to death and Hades. Turn to Revelation chapter 6, verse 8. I do. I think here death is personified as a thing, and we also see him essentially being a horse or a horseman as well. I do, and we see death and Hades more than once here in Revelation paired together. And so, yeah, I think it's basically just like Hebrew parallelism. It's death and Hades as a unit. Not in 6:8. No, yeah, in 6:8 it's death and Hades as well. So Revelation 6:8, 6:7. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of a fourth living creature say, "Come!" And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. They're a pair. They were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and wild beasts of the earth. What does Death and Hades represent? But death. Or in Revelation chapter 20. We'll start reading in verse 11. This is right after Satan is defeated. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who was seated on it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what is written in the books, according to what they had done. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. So, in this particular case, and I think this finishes out all of our references to Hades in the New Testament. What's the scene? Sheol, Hades, death, and here it splits out the sea, which is interesting. They are emptied of their dead. All right? And the idea here is, who's coming from that? All of the dead. Just the wicked? No, actually the scene here is not just the wicked. This is the righteous and the unrighteous being brought out and then being judged. All right? And then when essentially Sheol is emptied, when the place of the dead is emptied, what happens? Well, do you need Sheol anymore? No, you don't need Sheol, and it itself is going to be thrown into the lake of fire. The idea, of course, being for it to be destroyed. Remember, theologically speaking, going back to our discussions of the incarnation, all right? Man was meant to live eternally, physically, right? Adam could have lived physically forever, but he sinned, and so therefore, death came into the world. So in other words, the big part of God's plan to fix the world and all of its problems means fixing that and ultimately destroying the place of the dead as a part of that action. All right? There's no need for Sheol after everyone's been emptied. It should be destroyed, and this is the idea here. And so in this particular case, we once more get to an idea of Hades, of Sheol as a general place. Everyone's there. And so that's why, essentially, I think we should really look at Hades as a general place, not a specifically bad place, or even a specifically good place. Because the New Testament uses Hades in different ways. And you ultimately have to look at the context to figure out what it's talking about. And so if you have to look at the context, that means it has a more general idea. It's not always negative. Any questions about any of that? Yes?
You might have answered this in a previous week, but do you know the reason why the King James translators chose to put hell instead of Hades in all of these instances?
Ultimately, I don't know. No. I mean, back in the day, as we discussed a little earlier, hell had a wider meaning. And so that may be one reason why they tended to do that. They may have also wanted to avoid the Greek word Hades. It's always possible. But I can't really say for sure. It could be, it might not have even been their choice, because the King James was built off of Wycliffe's translation. And that might be something that Wycliffe did. And I actually haven't looked it up to see how often they keep to Wycliffe there. I'm not quite interested enough in that topic to see.
Well, they were Puritans, right? So could it be that they thought Hades was just some sort of pagan war that they were afraid of or something? I don't know.
Very well could be. I mean, we would have similar ideas often, right? Hades, well, that sounds pagan.
Right.
Well, the New Testament was written in a pagan language. And the New Testament has been translated into pagan languages ever since, right? As a part of the gospel mission. That's quite normal. And you can't, every time you want to, you can't make up new words in every language when you don't want to bring in these old concepts. Sometimes it's going to be kind of natural. You know, they have a word that's roughly equivalent to this, so we're just going to use that word. I think that's certainly the case here. And if we think about, you know, Bibles and Bible translations, what's the name of the Greek translation of the Old Testament? Septuagint. Oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, Sheol in the Septuagint is translated as Hades. And so for a first century Greek Christian, all right, not only are they hearing Hades perhaps from preachers, they're reading it in their Bibles. And if they're paying attention to the context in their Septuagint, they're going to be thinking, oh, this is the realm of the dead. And so it would have been fairly normal for them, I think. And they would know we're not supposed to be Greeks, right? Because that had been a struggle in Judaism for, by that time, a few hundred years, because the Greeks had been trying to force the Jews into being pagans for quite some time. And so that culture war would have been there, but yet they used the term Hades anyway. Yeah?
Was Polycarp a disciple of John?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know any of the fathers comment on this?
I don't know about the apostolic fathers. There's a pseudonymous, meaning not actually written by, book called The Life of Adam and Eve, all right, that is really largely a Christian work from like the first or second century, and it talks about some of this stuff. I'm actually planning on including it in the packet so you guys can read it. It also talks about multiple levels of heaven, which we'll have to talk about when we talk about Paul, as we know, because he talks about that. So I haven't looked at them exhaustively, so I can't say. Yeah.
Is there a difference between death and Hades?
I don't ultimately, I mean, yes, but they seem to be very closely paired, right? Because how do you get to the realm of the dead? You die. And so naturally they're going to be there. But you do have that, one of the horsemen is death, and he's followed closely by Hades, or maybe it's the opposite, where it's Hades and he's followed closely by death. And so they are different, but very closely paired, for sure. Yes.
In verse 13, we've got the sea gave up the dead who were in it, and is there a reason that the groups of people were separated?
I'm going to punt on that one and get back with you. I've thought about it, but I'm not sure yet. Thank you. Which makes really a lot of sense as a sequence. What comes first? Death or Sheol? Well, death, and then Sheol. So it makes perfect sense from a sequencing standpoint.
Yeah, there, in the Old Testament, there is a different word that means grave, right? Actual place where the body is.
I think so. There is also a word for the pit, which I think is essentially synonymous with the grave. I actually think it's, some English translations will sometimes translate Hades as the grave, and Sheol as the grave. Actually, that is a pretty good translation. It's certainly much better than hell, because the grave maintains that generic place, that generic idea that has neither punishment nor blessing. It's where everyone goes when they die. They go to the grave, right? And so, I'll look and check if there's any specific one that means specifically hole in ground, right? You're talking about graves?
Like, because Abraham bought a place to bury Sarah.
Mm-hmm. But that, I think, was a cave, right? But we could check. I could check to see what the word is there. It'd be good information to add. Yeah.
The reason why I was saying that is just if you want to say death and Hades are combined, not you, but one wants to say it. Death is your body died, and Hades is where you are now.
Right. A distinction between the soul and the body at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dualism. Let's talk about Gehenna just a little bit and just get started. All right. You know, Edward mentioned dualism, and back to the Essenes and Josephus, right? What's a proper relationship in the Christian mind between body and soul? All right, is the soul separable from the body? It seems to be the case. Is the soul supposed to be separate from the body? Absolutely not. All right, for humans to be normal means they are together. All right, which is why there is the idea of the resurrection from the dead. All right, a person's combination of soul and body is not temporary, is not for 10 years or 100 years, and then the rest of the time, it's disembodied human time. It's not the way the Bible presents it at all. It's you get your body back, and that's your ultimate future, because that's how God made us in the first place. Amen. Because God wanted there to be a creation, right? After sin, God did not say, okay, I'm just going to get rid of creation. No, he intends to redeem creation, and that includes the human body. For Gehenna, right? Gehenna is 100% of the time in the New Testament a negative thing. You don't go to Sheol. Or you don't go to Gehenna and it's okay. In every single case that we see Gehenna, this is always associated with bad. This, I think, is certainly distinguished from Sheol or Hades. But since we don't have a ton of time today, let's just talk about the Old Testament. In Joshua 15 and 18, which we're not going to turn to, these are the first occurrences of what is called the Valley of Hinnom. Okay. Hinnom. Okay. Valley of Hinnom. It is very close to the city of Jerusalem and shows up in Joshua as a boundary marker. because he's trying to specify at this particular point, Joshua 15 and 18. All right, what's the boundaries of the tribe of Judah? All right, and what's the boundaries of the tribe of Benjamin? That's because it's drawing essentially that border in words between Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin being just north of Judah, and Jerusalem being at the very northern point of the tribe of Judah. That's Joshua. I'll let you read that. It's in the notes I sent out. Turn to 2 Chronicles, though. It's a legitimate question what exactly we should pull from the Old Testament context into the New. It really is a legitimate question, and we will read it, and I will let you decide and think on your own. 2 Chronicles, chapter 28. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord as his father David had done, but he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He even made metal images for the Baals, or the Baals, and he made offerings in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and burned his sons as an offering, according to the abomination of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. He sacrificed and made offerings on the high places, and on the hills, and under every green tree. So the valley of Hinnom, in this particular case, is, not by its own fault, associated with idolatrous human sacrifice. Now turn to Jeremiah 7:32. Yes, we'll start off in verse 30, Jeremiah 7:30. For the sons of Judah have done evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set their detestable things in the house that is called by my name to defile it, and they have built the high places of Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, nor did it come into my mind. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it will no more be called Topheth, or the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they will bury in Topheth, because there is no room elsewhere. Jeremiah, he was preaching about what judgment against the nation? Who came and ultimately slaughtered
Babylon,
because of this was Jeremiah's general time frame. And so Jeremiah is talking about they're building high places. What does high places mean? Not sightseeing places, but, right? High place, put an altar there, sacrifice to pagan gods. This is idolatry talk. Now turn to 2 Kings. Chapter 23. Josiah, good king, bad king. Good king. 2 Kings 23. At the beginning. Then the king sent, and all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem were gathered to him. And the king went up to the house of the Lord, and with him all the men of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the priests and the prophets, all the people, both small and great. And he read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant that has been found in the house of the Lord. And the king stood by the pillar and made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and all his soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people joined in the covenant. And the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priest of the second order, and the keepers of the threshold, to bring out of the temple of the Lord all the vessels made for Baal, for Asherah, and for all the host of heaven. He burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of the Kidron, and carried their ashes to Bethel. Notice here, for those who were around for our study a few weeks ago, who did they make idols to? Baal and Asherah, which were local gods, and to all the host of heaven. What's that a reference to? Yeah, various spiritual beings that God has created. The host of heaven that were with God at the creation of the world. They had made idols for them and brought them into the temple. Josiah, being a good king, says, bring them all out, and they're ultimately they're destroyed out in the valley. Verse 5, and he deposed the priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to make sacrifices in the high places at the cities of Judah and around Jerusalem. Those also who burned incense to Baal, to the sun and the moon and the constellation. There's your host of heaven. And all the hosts of the heavens. Right? Everything. All that stuff up there. And he brought out the Asherah from the house of the Lord outside Jerusalem to the brook Kidron and burned it at the brook Kidron and beat it to dust and cast the dust of it upon the graves of the common people. And he broke down the houses of the male cult prostitutes who were in the house of the Lord, where the women wove hangings for the Asherah. And he brought all the priests out of the cities of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had made offerings from Geba to Beersheba. And he broke down the high places of the gates that were at the entrance of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, which were on one's left at the gate of the city. However, the priests of the high places did not come up to the altar of the Lord of Jerusalem, but they ate unleavened bread among the brothers. And he defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, that no one might burn his son or his daughter as an offering to Molech. And so forth. This is your case of the valley of Hinnom here. What's Josiah doing? He's doing the opposite, actually, of what Ahaz was doing. Instead of setting up the Valley of Hinnom for child sacrifices, he's going to those places where they had done that, and then he's making those ritually undefiled for those religious practices. Right? This is Josiah, being a good king, going on the attack. You can't do this anymore because I just messed up your pagan place of worship. And that's all this activity is essentially, in one form or another, that kind of activity. Of course, this would be, from a time perspective, before Jeremiah. All right, Jeremiah would be post this time in Josiah. Okay, so think about that. And in the document, you have all the references to Gehenna. That's where we will, Lord willing, begin next week. Think about, should we bring in these ideas? Should we not? At the very least, think through those passages about Gehenna. All right, what's going on there? How much of it is near-term death? How much of it is far-term, eternal-type destruction? That'll be a big question that we have to work through next time. Any closing thoughts before we dismiss? As always, if you have any questions or thoughts during the week, just send me an email, and we'll talk about that. Roy, will you pray for us, please?